The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We call this the Empowerment Hour, because no matter what your station in life, your education, your age, your background, I promise you, you will learn new insights today that can help you in making more constructive decisions and choices. Today, we're going to start at the top of our show with, instead of health nutrition, which will come after this, and also medical schools flunk at keeping the faculty off Big Pharma speaking circuit. That'll be an interesting story. And also, are we too dumb for democracy? The logic behind self-delusion. We have a lot to share with you, but we're going to begin where we left off yesterday. Yesterday, I had on Dr. David Raznick. Dr. Raznick is going to talk today about IRS, Immune Reconstitution Syndrome, and a critique of the AIDS paradigm. Dr. Raznick is a medical researcher specializing in AIDS, cancer, and protease inhibitors and clinical diagnostics. He was the first scientist to synthesize a particular inhibitor of cysteine proteases used to destroy tissue related to arthritis, cancer, and various parasites. He has worked within the pharmaceutical industry. He has also been a visiting researcher at the University of California, Berkeley. And more than anything, he is a scientist. He has patents on the protease inhibitors, which have been used in the treatment of persons with AIDS. Now, there was a little background. First, let's say hello to him. Nice to have you back with us today.
It's good to be back.
I'm going just to give a little extended introduction to the theme, and then I want you to take us through this in step-by-step sequence, okay?
All right.
First, my own observation. After I saw that, even though I believed initially that an HIV virus had been fully isolated, that it was the cause of AIDS, after working 10 years prior to 1984 with some gay physicians and lots of persons suffering from various illnesses that were unique to the fast-track gay community and unique to the fast-track heterosexual community, mainly those using ammonium nitrates and other and who had multiple sexually transmitted diseases, hepatitis and whatnot, herpes 6, I saw that I was able to create some protocols to help them. And in 12 cases, those who decided to go full force, I mean 100% committed to protocols at the Tri-State Healing Center in New York, and under the supervision of our medical faculty, I created protocols where 12 individuals came in 6 days a week for an average of 14 months every week. And they had intravenous vitamin C drips with glutathione, aqua vitamin A, and selenium and B-complex, up to 200,000 milligrams a day. They had homeopathy. They had bitter melon juice. They had every known antiretroviral and immune-modulating protocol possible. They also had to give up the fast-track lifestyle. And they did meditations and other ways of healing the body and mind. At the end of this time period, where they were meticulously and constantly tested their entire blood workup done, sometimes at a cost of about $1,200 per week just for the blood workups. And by the way, none of them paid a penny for their therapy. It was all, I donated it all, which was hundreds of thousands of dollars. So they didn't lay out a nickel. At the end of that time, all 12 were HIV negative. Not one of them had a single opportunistic infections. In fact, their immune systems were as healthy as a person could be. We then presented these people by invitation on PBS over a period of about a year on Tony Brown's journal at Tony Brown's request, and he had his own physician and group of people reading their medical reports from beginning to end to show they actually had all these illnesses, they were this sick, and today they were completely normal and vitally healthy. And then they came on the show. All of those interviews are on the archives. On YouTube, you can watch them for yourself. It was then decided that we would hold a press conference. It took a year because not only were the people I personally work with invited, but we invited anyone who was a long-term survivor in good health to come forward with their physician and their medical records to prove that their holistic protocols, whatever they may have been, were the cause of them getting well. But they could not be on any of the traditional AIDS medications. And indeed, we had people, Richard Pierce, and people from all different walks of life, from every aspect of the AIDS community, come forward. We had over 100 cases that were selected. We then got together a group of independent scientists who reviewed the protocols that each of these individuals had undergone to see could they find a scientific basis for why these people got well. So the argument wouldn't be, well, they're just in a remission, or, well, it must have been some delayed effect of AZT or DDI or DDC or protease inhibitors. Or, well, how do you know they even had the disease to begin with? So these people had to independently review each person and say, okay, this person was on high doses of vitamin C. Is there anything in the scientific literature that could show that vitamin C has antiviral and immune modulating qualities? They collected 26,000 studies in peer-reviewed literature to support that part of it. We then sent out three separate press releases. We hired a PR firm. I remember it was $5,000 a week for them to reach out to every member of the American media to invite them. All these people then came into New York City, and then we held this press conference. All the people were there. Their medical doctors were there. Their medical records were there. The staff of independent scientists were there and professors. Not a single member of the American media showed up. Not one. Now, you would have thought if you were claiming remarkable improvement in a killer disease like AIDS that someone would have found it interesting, if nothing else, just to come to try to debunk it, say it was all nonsense, all quackery. No one came. Now, what was interesting is if no one came, then they didn't have to report upon what they weren't aware of. Fortunately, I filmed it, so we do have it as a matter of record. But if you then come up with a drug that's supposed to treat AIDS and has some improvement, even though you have no real science to back it up on, suddenly that's worldwide news, it's headlines in the New York Times, the stock in the company goes up. Now, that is one issue I want Dr. David Rasnick to address. The idea that when you do have proof that challenges any aspects at all of the AIDS paradigm, the mainstream media, the scientific community, the medical community, the government agencies all joined together to go into some form of gross denialism. Now today, they have a new article out of Stanford that says the following, quote, expansion of the HIV screening cost-effective in reducing spread of AIDS, Stanford study Stowe, the first paragraph, quote, an expanded U.S. program of HIV screening and treatment could prevent as many as 212,000 new infections over the next 20 years and proved to be very cost-effective, according to Stanford University. Now, that's strange because we have thousands of outstanding scientists, researchers, medical doctors, and activists, and journalists who have actually looked at the data, looked at the science, found it so replete with contradictions, discrepancies, and out-and-out fraud that they have decided to put their reputations at risk and go on the record opposing the orthodox point of view. There's nearly 2,800 on the record. And yet, they all claim that the HIV antibody test is not a gold standard, is not accurate, cross-reacts with over 75 different diseases, and therefore should not be used at all. So what is it that these scientists, journalists, activists know including Nobel Prize winners like Kerry Mullis. And this Stanford University group doesn't, and yet this will go out, and everybody will be expected to take an HIV antibody test as if that's accurate and normal and predictive. I want Dr. Rasnick to deal with that. And finally, Dr. Rasnick, you've seen what they have done to journalists of impeccable reputation, such as Celia Farber and John Lauritsen, Charles Ortlieb, Anita Ostrom, including gays. Three of those individuals are gay. And actually ran one of the most progressive gay magazines in the world, Charles Ortlieb's New York Native. And any other gays who, when they look at the evidence and they see discrepancies and they have questions and they offer legitimate challenges, they are immediately attacked. They are ostracized. They are excluded from any dialogue. You will not hear them on Pacifica stations. And because of the rancor and the animus by a tiny infinitesimal fraction of completely wrong-headed activists who think that there's only one way of looking at AIDS, and that is the orthodox view, and anyone who offers any other opinion is immediately smacked down and destroyed. Fortunately, she decided finally to fight back, and she is now winning in her lawsuits against them. And as we have repeatedly stated, the moment anyone in ACT UP or any of these other organizations decides to make an opinion that goes from opinion, which is fair, they can have any opinion they want, and that's fine, to slander, they will be sued. And I mean pursued to the ends of the earth. They will not hide in a hole deep enough for us to drag their asses out and put them in a court of law to show who's really behind them. Now, this leads me to the last thing. I said this was an extended introduction, and I will not interrupt you in exploring all this. This is today. Recently on this program, I posited that the reason that we have not grown as a society, intellectually, culturally, spiritually, emotionally, or solved any of our problems, was because we are glued with elephant glue or gorilla glue to our belief systems, the paradigm. And the paradigm holds the truth, irrespective of whether it's a universal truth, which rarely it is, more often than not, it's an individual truth. So if they're wrong, then everyone who believes in it must deny that it's wrong and accept that it's real. And I've said, as long as you're a Democrat, you will never know the full truth. As long as you're a Republican, you'll never know the truth. You must become independent to see where the truth is and therefore align yourself with wherever that truth may be, but not have to take on all the other non-truths for one truth. If there's 100 lies and half-truths and there's one truth, I'm not going to buy into the whole 100 to get one. So anyhow, this came out today, and this is my final thought. Are we too dumb for democracy? The logic behind self-delusion, I would apply this to the entire medical paradigm, to the entire scientific paradigm, to all the people in the media, and to the average person, and certainly all the activists and the ACT UP people. And I'll quote this verbatim from Stephen Dufresio of News Junkie Post. Quote, a recent cognitive study, as reported by the Boston Globe, concluded, quote, facts don't necessarily have the power to change our minds. In fact, quite the opposite. In a series of studies, researchers at the University of Michigan found that when misinformed people, particularly political partisans, were exposed to corrected facts in recent stories, they rarely changed their minds. In fact, they often became even more strongly set in their beliefs. Facts, they found, were not curing misinformation. Like an underpowered antibiotic, facts could actually make misinformation even stronger. In light of these findings, researchers concluded that a defense mechanism, which they labeled backfire, was preventing individuals from producing more rational thought. The result is a self-delusion that appears so regularly in normal thinking that we fail to detect it in ourselves, and often in others, when faced with facts that do not fit seamlessly into our individual belief systems, our minds automatically reject or backfire the presented facts. The result of backfire is that we become even more entrenched in our beliefs, even if those beliefs are totally or partially false. Quote, the general idea is that it's absolutely threatening to admit you're wrong, and a natural defense mechanism to avoid that cognitive dissonance. Unquote from Professor Brendan Nyhan, the lead researcher. The conclusion made here is facts often do not determine our beliefs, but rather our beliefs, usually non-rational beliefs, determine the facts that we accept. In reality, we often base our opinions on our beliefs, and that ties in what I've been saying. Our beliefs come from where? Our belief systems. And if our belief systems are biased, look at how many people in different religious beliefs, including Sharia law, believe that it's real when it's not. There's no universal truth to it. It's just what some people at some point decided to be called a law, and therefore everyone had to obey by it or believe in it or be excommunicated or punished. So one day you wake up and you don't even challenge anything any longer because you can't challenge them, because your belief system doesn't allow you to until you become independent. And so we end up with an uneasy relationship with facts. And rather than facts driving beliefs, our beliefs can dictate the facts we choose to accept. That's my introduction to this whole theme. I would like for you to take this, and in light that you've experienced all this, and also immune reconstitution syndrome, I am presenting no other information until you've had a chance to share all of yours uninterrupted. The forum is yours.
Okay. Thanks, Gary. This is very interesting, and I appreciate the approach that you're taking, because what we're dealing with here with AIDS and virtually all the other problems in the United States and maybe even around the world are political in nature and have to do with what you interesting question you posed. Are we too dumb for democracy? I personally don't think so. Democracy, as the founding fathers actually stated at the very beginning, requires free and open discourse and debate, and it has to be practiced and ongoing. What we're dealing with in the United States certainly is more akin to propaganda than facts or arguments, which require practice in order to understand and to delve into very serious and important questions. We don't have that in this country. The more important the question, the less discussion and debate and free speech we have. We have basically propaganda. And as I mentioned yesterday, the American taxpayers have spent over, I guess you mentioned it, over $300 billion on AIDS in the 30 years of AIDS. And that can buy a lot of consent and certainly a lot of propaganda. I personally believe that given the chance for people to actually be exposed to, listen to, and participate in discussions and debates, that they are indeed capable of democracy. That's why the government learned a very important point during the Vietnam War that Daniel Ellsberg was able to point out to us with his heroic efforts, is that the government cannot really do what it wants to do if there's a free and open discourse and a free and open press. And that's what led to the embedded journalism in the Iraq War. And now we have embedded journalists in AIDS and probably any other major area that has political consequences. That's basically why there is no reporting of this alternative views to AIDS in the United States. Explains why you're very interesting and important, and in my view probably correct results with your non-toxic approaches to dealing with biological issues, health issues, medical issues of these gay men and their lifestyle and everything, why it worked, and you got zero response or interest from the media. And recently, I guess it was just a few weeks ago, that now I'm getting more into the particulars of what I wanted to say about AIDS, that the CDC now is pushing for every American to be tested for antibodies to HIV. And this started back in the 90s with the apparently innocuous act of changing AIDS to HIV-AIDS, It had very devastating consequences. The first was it kept the AIDS epidemic from disappearing by defining tens of thousands of healthy people as full-blown AIDS cases. The CDC, as I said, is trying to get everyone to start taking these HIV tests. They're putting ads out for everybody in the country to get tested for antibodies to HIV. Of course, this is a billion-dollar boon to the HIV testing and drug companies. All of the unfortunate people testing positive will be added to the rolls of HIV/AIDS. A person tattooed with the indelible HIV/AIDS will invariably, at some point, be pressured into taking the anti-HIV drugs. A few months ago, I witnessed a platoon of infectious disease doctors, surgeons, a hospital mediator, pressure, intimidate, cajole, threaten, and humiliate an HIV-positive woman, a friend of mine, who refused to take the anti-HIV drugs. She was strong enough to prevail. But most HIV-positive people are brainwashed by the AIDS propaganda and are no match for such pressure, and they wind up taking the drugs. HIV/AIDS conceals the fact that since 1996, around three-quarters of all new AIDS cases in the USA are free of disease. Yet the CDC estimates over 90% of these people are taking the highly toxic and ultimately lethal combinations of anti-HIV drugs called HART. As a consequence, HART is making tens of thousands, perhaps millions of people around the world, seriously sick with AIDS-defining diseases and a growing list of so-called non-AIDS-defining diseases. And HART is killing thousands of people. To hide the fact that HART is causing AIDS and death, a new disease was invented in the 1990s called immune reconstitution syndrome, or IRS. And by definition, IRS only appears in people who starts taking HART. In other words, it only shows up after they start taking the anti-HIV drugs. There are now officially 45 IRS diseases as of 2008. It used to be if a person was HIV positive and came down with KS, MAC, TB, cryptococcus, PCP, cytomegalovirus, histoplasmosis, herpes, leukoencephalopathy, leprosy, meningitis, lymphoma, so on and so forth, they'd be classified as an AIDS case. Nowadays, if a person comes down with any of the same diseases, but only after they start taking HART, it's not called AIDS, it's called IRS. There's a huge literature on IRS. The typical estimate is 25% of people taking HART come down with IRS. And the range is from anywhere from 4 to 66%. So IRS is a major problem. That's why whole conferences are devoted to it, and virtually every day, I scan the literature every day on the Internet, and there's at least one paper on IRS. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. The peculiarities of the six or so definitions of IRS include only a fraction of the HART toxicities. A 2009 paper documented 620 adverse events in 498 patients, of which only 23 to 41% were labeled IRS. The quickest and most humane way to end this insanity, in my view, is to outlaw the HIV test. Without the test, there is no HIV/AIDS, and then there's no HART, and then there's no IRS. Now, I've said it pretty, I hope, succinctly, and I'm willing, happy to continue this discussion, answer any of your questions.
Yes, let's go through three segments. First, for those people who still believe in the myth, where there is no scientific justification, that the HIV antibody test is 100% gold standard, explain why getting this test, if you have herpes, or if you're pregnant, or have measles, or hepatitis, or malaria, or tuberculosis, or any number of conditions, or combinations of those conditions, could test you positive.
Yeah, if you have a flu or a flu vaccination, for example, anything that causes your immune system to be boosted, you can have positive nonspecific antibodies that react to this test. In fact, I imagine that the antibodies, they are nonspecific antibodies that these tests are picking up. That's why people who are sick, for example, will be positive to these tests. Very healthy people tend not to. because their immune system is not activated. But interestingly, Dr. Roberto Giraldo did an experiment where he got some physicians to volunteer. They donated their blood. These were all healthy physicians. They donated their blood, and Roberto divided the blood into two portions. One portion, he diluted the blood 400-fold as the protocol for the test requires, and all of those samples that were diluted 400-fold came out HIV negative. The other half of the blood that he did not dilute at all, 100% of those doctors were now HIV positive. It's totally arbitrary as to whether or not a person is HIV positive or HIV negative. It actually depends on how you do the test. There is an idea of how recently a person has become HIV positive, what people have done have developed these non-toxic or less sensitive HIV tests where they dilute the blood 20,000-fold in order to then make sure that will be negative on that test. And then if the people, for example, come in, they're HIV positive on the normal test, and then if they're negative on the very diluted test, then it was a fairly recent test. If they're positive on both of these tests, then they've been HIV positive for a long time. And it totally has to do with how you do the test, whether or not a person is positive or negative. So the tests are totally worthless. They should be outlawed. They are a scandal. They are a crime.
But they're very profitable, and Robert Gallo and others make a lot of money off of it. Now, this goes back to what I said earlier when I was talking about the concept that we can have facts that are based upon truth and proven, but if those challenge our opinions, whether you're doctor, scientist, or media, doesn't matter. You suspend rational thought, and you have that backfire, where it prevents the individual from producing a rational thought. They end up in self-delusion that then protects their belief systems. Because think of how many people would be wrong. Think of the medical scandal if we had to acknowledge everything that we were told is right about the AIDS war is wrong about the AIDS war. We would have the largest medical scandal in world history. We'd have millions of lawsuits flooding people, doctors who gave them the antibody tests and gave them the treatments and the drug companies. So go through each one of the basic so-called truths of the war on AIDS and share with us your personal and professional opinion, as well as speaking on behalf as former president of the AIDS Advisory Panel of South Africa under President Mbeki, as well as the president of the group of Rethinking AIDS. So you are qualified to speak on behalf of those individuals who've shared their opinions on the record with you. And we're talking about thousands of individuals with professors of virology, professors of molecular biology, professors of immunology, emeritus professors of science, and Nobel Prize winners. So we're talking about a rather heady group, and yet they have been denied any legitimacy. Anytime you hear an AIDS, what I call the truth deniers, the people who refuse to acknowledge the truth, they refuse to acknowledge that anyone offering an opinion challenging theirs is legitimate on any level, scientifically, with no credibility. Of course, we have just the opposite. So I want you to go through now, and you show us what you believe are the myths about AIDS, and then we will put that into the context of why we cannot change.
Okay, I think I'm going to turn it on its head for just a moment. You bring up the very important point that facts don't seem to hold much sway. The reason I think that is true is not because of facts per se. I think it has to do with people have to practice thinking. They have to practice their critical faculties. And that is what is lacking in society. Not facts, but the ability to even know how to use facts. Facts without interpretation, without understanding, without discourse, without putting these things into context are pretty much meaningless. And they hold no sway if you're going up against propaganda. Propaganda is a daily thing. It's what advertisers know very well. You just keep pounding and pounding and pounding away. And then people don't think anymore. It's reflexive. And I think that's basically what we're up against. That's one thing. It's just reflexive behavior. The second thing is, as you pointed out, is to nobody's advantage who are in the position of comfort and wealth, like the people that work on AIDS, for example, and the government, the pharmaceutical industries, and other places. They're happy with the way it is. They have a great deal to lose if you start questioning and challenging these things. So they're not inclined to want to listen or to admit anything. So I think your program and the others are around the country are useful in certainly for bringing out facts that people aren't familiar with, they haven't heard, but also giving them practice at using these facts and then weighing them against other people's facts and then deciding where the truth lies. Now I'll try to address the specifics with regards to AIDS. The AIDS dogma, or catechism as I call it, is that it's contagious. In other words, you can catch it from other people. It's sexually transmitted. They say that's the primary way that you transmit AIDS. And that the contagious or causative agent is a virus called a retrovirus, HIV. And that the drugs that are designed to inhibit or kill or prevent the replication of HIV will prolong life. And that they also have tests that will actually tell you whether or not you are infected with this virus and that you will come down with AIDS and AIDS-defining diseases and die 10 years or so afterwards. Well, the first thing, all of those, by the way, are wrong. There's not a single thing that I can think of that the mainstream catechism or dogma about AIDS is true. Every last statement is wrong. AIDS is clearly not a contagious disease. As we talked about yesterday, the CDC, every year for the past 25 years, has said 1 million Americans are HIV positive. That's a very flat number. If it's a contagious or sexually transmitted disease, it should either be going up, peaking, coming down, can't stay flat. They say that the drugs are prolonging life. If they were prolonging life of HIV-positive people, then there should be more and more HIV-positive people who are alive, and, of course, the numbers are flat. If it were a contagious disease, infectious agent doesn't know whether you're male, female, gay, straight, white or black, African, Caucasian, or whatever. Yet in the USA, 8 out of 9 AIDS cases are men to this day. Around two-thirds or thereabouts are gay men. Women rarely get AIDS unless they're drug users. And AIDS is clearly not a contagious disease, not like any other contagious disease that people are familiar with, the measles, the mumps, the flu, smallpox, anything, you know, behaves completely differently than AIDS does. In terms of the sexual transmission, it's clearly not. I mean, if you have eight out of nine Americans, AIDS cases, men, you know, where are the women? It's basically, they estimate, 90% of the population are heterosexual, and then there's bisexuals. There should be pretty much an equal distribution of AIDS among the sexes in the U.S. We're told that there's a 50-50 distribution between the sexes in Africa, for example. Why not the U.S.? The tests, as we've already talked about, are based on determining nonspecific antibodies in a person. And these nonspecific antibodies can be the result of many different causes. Over 70, I think, have been documented. And the inserts that come with the HIV tests themselves say that the test cannot be used to diagnose AIDS or even infection with HIV. Even in the inserts, they tell you right there that these things are pretty much meaningless. There's no reference standard to even determine what the antibodies that you have are due to. In terms of the therapies, they say very clearly that none of these drugs prevent a person from coming down with AIDS diseases. They don't even know if they'll prolong your life, even though they claim it all the time. And the inserts that come with the drugs, they say they have no information as to whether or not you'll live longer with these drugs or not. Let's see. What else? I know I left some things out. There's so many things here. What would you like me to address
The treatment is extending life, and without the treatment, a person will die.
Oh, yes. Clearly, I think I mentioned this a little bit yesterday, the CDC's own statistics show that the natural decline in AIDS and AIDS deaths that started around 1992-93, AIDS started declining at that point, that natural decline stopped within months after the introduction of the combination therapy known as HART in the fall of 1996. Since 1996, the natural decline in AIDS and in AIDS deaths stopped. In fact, AIDS diseases and even deaths are starting to creep up ever since the HART was introduced in the latter part of 1996. So the CDC's own data indicate that the anti-HIV drugs known as HART are not only not prolonging life, a strong case can be made for the fact that these drugs are actually causing AIDS and AIDS deaths, which indeed they are, except they go by a new name now, as we've just discussed, immune reconstitution syndrome. I guess that's it, unless you want me to keep going on that.
Well, no, just my final comment for you today. As a scientist who had an impeccable reputation, and as someone who was respected for your innovation, what was it like when the day came when you began to see yourself ridiculed, mocked, demeaned, slandered, and libeled by those who had no background in science, mainly the radical gay activists, who were aligned philosophically, if not necessarily financially, with the AIDS paradigm, who chose not to dialogue and to have open and democratic discourse, but rather to have only one rule, theirs, only one reality, theirs, and were as mean-spirited as any fascist could be, and literally created a medical McCarthyism within the gay AIDS paradigm community. So if you were gay as an activist, as a physician, as a scientist, you were vilified, as I have will be having a program with only gays on in the very near future. Journalists, medical doctors, scientists, and journalists, all of whom will tell you that the moment they questioned the HIV equals AIDS paradigm, they were attacked and excluded. And it surprised them, as a community that had been vilified and marginalized and harassed with massive homophobia, now they were turning on their own. And that caused enormous amount of consternation and grief in those who said, how could you attack me when I'm merely looking at a different point of view than you? And yet that has been the common theme within the radicalized part of the community that believes that you should not have any rights whatsoever as a human being. There is no democracy. There's no freedom of speech. There's no open forum for you if you challenge anything at all within the AIDS community. And we allow this to happen.
Yeah, it's actually getting worse. The attacks are more vitriolic. They're meaner. And I just take that as a sign that we're making progress, because in the old days, they would just there would be silence. You would be ignored. But now there's websites devoted to attacking so-called denialists, and there's out-and-out lies that are against us that criticize or ask questions about AIDS. And it doesn't matter who you are. You can be a scientist. You can be anybody. You can be, like I said, this woman that I was in the hospital when I saw those things, how the AIDS establishment attacked her for refusing to take the anti-HIV drugs. It can be anybody. Now, as a scientist, it started for me back in the 80s when I first started questioning the contagious HIV hypothesis. And I actually lost some friends and colleagues of mine that I worked with. Some of the ones that we kept a collaboration going, we just mutually agreed not to talk about it anymore because it was too embarrassing for them, at least. I'm quite happy to talk about this stuff. But a number of other people who used to be colleagues and friends, they just sort of disappeared and don't talk. And over the years, certainly now, I'm just like with Peter Duisberg, I'm totally blacklisted, just like in the McCarthy era. You know, Peter can't get any grants. He just lost, just last Friday, he told me, he lost 75% of his meager funding because of the foundation. One of the guys who was supporting him, his wife died, and he's gone now too. So the new board stopped giving him any more money. He can't get any grants. I'm totally unable to get a job at all to do any of my research on any place. And, you know, it's just the price one pays to speak out, unfortunately. So this is all part of that control. And I think Daniel Ellsberg, these things are all connected. That the Daniel Ellsberg thing, the Pentagon Papers, the embedded journalist, dissidents doing, these are all of a piece. People would like to separate it and say, no, it's about the Vietnam War, or it's about global warming, or it's about AIDS, or about whatever, or Iraq or something, but it's all the same thing, the same tactics, the strategies. And if you start making any progress at all, you will be attacked. Not your ideas. Nobody will address your arguments or anything, but they will tell lies about you. They will try to just really rip you apart, on a personal basis. And all I can say is, I personally, these things are not nice, but I personally want them to keep showing who they really are, show their true colors. And then compare them with Celia Farber, Peter Duesberg, me, and all the other people that we talk. We talk about ideas and about evidence and information. We don't call them names and try to spread ad hominem attacks and things. But that's exactly what's directed at us. And I think the more that this happens, and the more programs like yours, where you can compare the different approaches, that then people will start getting a practice at weighing. It's like jurors, Who do you trust? What do you believe? Whose evidence? The prosecution or the defense? I think it's a process, it's exercise. And I don't think it's just who has the best facts. It's a process of how you use those facts and how you convey that information and how you respect other people, how you treat them, and how they treat you.
I agree with that. As you know, I wrote the first major article challenging the misinformation on the AIDS. As a journalist, as a scientist, as a clinician, I was there before the first cases and saw where the discrepancies were and worked with people with AIDS. So they can't say that there's an AIDS denialism. There is a challenge to the prevailing paradigm. But they want to make it something that sticks in people's minds. And they could get away with that at one time. But today, as you know, we're approaching 3,000 dissidents who have gone on the record and risked their reputations. We're not just a few people anymore. And yes, the Peter Duesbergs and yourself and others have paid a price for it. However, now, I got a letter from David Ida Motivox. We have 10 million people in one rating period alone listening over the internet to this radio show. This is the number one listened to radio program in the world for independent minded thinking. Most of those independent people at one time were true believers in their paradigm. They were as limited in their view as what I shared earlier. They were the ones who were too dumb to think for themselves, so they allowed their spokespersons, like the Economist today, the economy is rebounding. No, those are the people that you shouldn't listen to, and people are not any longer. Get your, flu shot. Or, take your synthetic hormone replacement therapy. Or, your kid should be in pre-kindergarten. In fact, you should have a monitor hooked up, a teaching monitor to teach French while it's still as a developing fetus. I mean, the insanity of what people have allowed themselves to become a part of is finally, even to the dumbest Americans, and you have to really use the large D when talking about how dumb most Americans are, they are getting it. So now we are no longer a tiny minority. We are 44% of the American public. We care about the poor. We care about the middle class. We care about the scientists and physicians who want to do good medicine, good science. We care about the journalists like Celia Farber who want to do good journalism. We care about the truth seekers. But we are challenging, everywhere possible, the prevailing power structures. And when that happens, you have to be prepared for the backlash. The difference is, today, we also have a team of lawyers looking at everything that's written on any blog site, and we have a group of geeks who can go in and find out who the true owners of these websites are. And when we find out there's a chemical company behind it with a front group, with a foundation, we will sue them for hundreds of millions of dollars. The difference is, I'm not a Gandhian pacifist. I believe in going after the creeps to go after you and stop it. Otherwise, you get stuck with a thousand needles and slashes as you walk away. I believe in facing them and drawing them into court. And every time we go to court, we win. We never have lost a lawsuit when we go into court. And that's where we're taking some of these people, because I want the good science to be inside in court as a matter of record. And I want the media to pay attention when we win one of these suits. And then we look back at these people and their funding and their statements and how inaccurate they've been and what their real motives are. Then the public goes, whoa, now we know who these people are. Now we know why they wouldn't debate. Now we know why they were making all this money, hundreds of billions of dollars, and people were dying because of them. So there's not just one way to win this battle. And you don't win a battle in this area by simply walking away as if the opposition will sooner or later run out of bullets to shoot at the back of your head. Thank you very much for being with us, David.
Just a real quick one. We are suing Glaxo right now and some physicians that were directly responsible for killing a man here in California on AZT.
Great. Okay, well, let us know, because we have over 100 activist lawyers who do not work for the dollar. Therefore, we can never run out of money, because we have passion and truth, and we're going after these people now. And we're going after them in the way that they're not prepared, non-emotionally, practically, and we're going to dig the truth, because too many people have been sacrificed at the altar of greed, avarice, hubris, and indifference. Just as all these people's homes have been lost, just as so many people are on the streets today, not because they deserve to be there, but because they trusted the wrong people. And you are absolutely correct. It's all interconnected. Go behind all these myths and you'll find pharmaceutical giants making hundreds of millions and billions of dollars in profit. But they're not the ones you're going to see out front. You'll see their army of red ants out there. You'll see their foundations, scientists for hire. And then you'll see the activists and the so-called consumerists. So we're just unpeeling each layer of this, and as it happens, you will see in the new documentary and the new articles we have coming out where the truth is. Thank you very much for all your efforts. I appreciate it, David.
If I can help you, just let me know.
Will do. DavidRaznick.com. DavidRaznick, RaznickK.com. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
I was all right. For a while, I could smile.
Everyone, I'm Gary Noll. Well, we went a little longer than what I thought we'd go, so I didn't have a chance to explore some other areas today, health and nutrition, for example. I'll get to several of these on our afternoon show. In fact, we have an interesting guest, and I want to get, first of all, who do we have coming up at 3 o'clock? Kara Lee's in studio, and our executive producer of our documentary series here, Valerie Van Cleve. Hi, Valerie.
Hi, Gary.
Hi, Kara.
Hey, Gary.
Who's our guest at 3 o'clock?
We currently don't have a guest actually scheduled for our 3 o'clock program today.
Oh, well, that's good. Then you know what that means. Commentaries and questions and feedback from the audience. So get as many questions as you can, so I will answer those. I'm out on the road. We're filming. And bring us up to date on what you need, and then we'll go to Valerie.
All right, sure. I came in studio because, you know, it's a busy, busy time of year, and we've got a lot of different things going on here at the office, and we definitely need a couple extra hands. Just some people who can come in, particularly this week, would be really helpful, and just kind of give us a hand, help us box some things up, and get some things out and on the road before the holidays come. So if you can, if you are available to come in this week, please give Michael, our assistant in the office, a call at 646-926-5429. Again, his number is 646-926-5429, and you'll be getting in touch with Michael.
could, because last week we helped give an awful lot of food. We're talking about thousands of pounds to a church group and to a school group and to a Newark financially challenged parents group. And this week we're giving thousands upon thousands of books and videos to our service men and women in Iraq and Afghanistan. And all this stuff has gone out. But we have so much we're doing to give to charity. And this is what this is. So if we have some hands that can help us get this stuff out of the office and in the mail to help these people, it would be good, because we just don't have the staff, extra staff, to do this since we're all working nonstop. Valerie.
Hi, Gary. Well, in the video production department, we're really overwhelmed, finishing several fantastic projects, and we're looking to hire someone who can do research for us.
And full-time.
Full-time, and this would be research on our up-and-coming documentary, Poverty, Inc. So if you have a background in research, please, if you would send your email, send me an email with your resume. My name is Valerie Van Cleve, and my email address is vvancleve@garynoel.com. That's vancleve@garynoel.com. vvancleve@garynoel.com. And you could also reach me at my number, which is 646-926-5441. 646-926-5441.
Let me just bring people up to date. And I have a lot on health and nutrition, on medical schools flunking, how to keep Big Pharma out of their classrooms. And I'm going to do a lot on the environment today. And I'm going to take calls today. I haven't had a chance, and I look forward to that in 2 hours from now. But what we're doing is, I have a whole lot still to film in the next 2 weeks to finish up Poverty, Inc., which we've been filming for 2.5 years. I'm filming experts in the area of why we got to where we are today. It didn't happen just because of this subprime meltdown. It's been going on for over 35 years. So we are putting together each piece of this puzzle. And so I'm filming around the country. This week it'll be UCLA at Berkeley. Then it'll be tent cities in Arizona, in Ohio, in northern Texas, and outside of Las Vegas. There's a whole lot of poor people. But these are the new poor. And these are people who weren't poor a year or two ago. And we're showing that we are ill-prepared to help these people in the United States, because our priorities, unfortunately, are on war and the massive financing of the war machine and the people who support that. So if you don't have enough money for everything, then how do you decide where your money goes? And if you choose not to help the people stay in their homes, then why don't you help the people stay in their homes? What is the rationale of keeping someone in their home, a family in their home, versus throwing them out of their home? There has to be a benefit to that. And the benefit is there. The banks benefit. And we'll explain, and I'm showing why. So all those things are being done. Our other film is finished. It's just waiting. This is going to be finished. And then right behind that, we're finishing up Greed Street, the film based on Wall Street. So we have three major feature films that will be coming out in the summer. They'll be done, wrapped up, edited. Now, Valerie just finished putting to bed, and I watched it before I went out of town, a brand new self-empowerment film. No one's seen it before. We'll be mentioning that next week. And then she's finishing up another one this week, which will be the week after. These I filmed earlier this year, very important topics. Richard Gale, or Richard Polneski, just finished editing principal photography for the new special we're putting up on PBS Satellite next month on overcoming depression and anxiety. That's getting out there. So we have 16 feature films, all of which were filmed nonstop over the last 3 years, plus new books, all written into the publishers. We have a lot of great material coming so that we can focus upon important social issues and provide the tools for social change that are necessary. So on all levels, good information is being provided, essential information to help people make the important changes in their lives. It's not just talk. It's tools for change. The paradigm is shifting for those who are interested. So that's that. I want to thank you all for listening to this hour of our program. I look forward to sharing more on our next. Have a good day.
You ask how much I need you. Must I explain? I need you, oh my darling. Like roses need rain. You ask how long I'll love you. Till the 12th of never, I'll still be loving.
Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.
I'll love you till the bluebells forget to bloom.